Okay, this is what I think the Lord would like us to more deeply expand on from last week, which is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I think that's important. We touched on it last week. Janet got me off on a tangent, which was a good tangent. You know, she reminded me that Jesus was hung on a tree, and there were two trees in the garden. You know, and when Jesus was hung on a tree, it was the tree of cursing. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. And it was the tree that was tempting man in the garden to go beyond direct union and intimacy with God and to move into our own human knowledge and discernment of good and evil. To move into our own ability to make moral and ethical decisions apart from intimate communion and hearing the voice of our Creator. Okay, so the knowledge of the tree of good and evil set us up for the path that we have gone along from that moment on. A path of independence from God. A path of, I can ethically decide what is good and what is evil. I can use rational thought. I can use my own human goodness to ascertain what things are good and what things are evil. I can make thousands of decisions a day apart from an intimate two-way conversation that should be flowing at every minute with my Creator. That's the evil of eating that fruit. You see, even the good part of that tree is evil, because man's goodness apart from God is the Tower of Babel. It's an abomination. It's idolatry. It's humanism. It's Greek thought. It's an antichrist spirit. Because even the good is not good apart from his communication. You know, the proverb says, there is a way that seems right to a man, but the way thereof is death. Jesus said, I don't judge according to what my eyes see. I don't give my judgments based on human reasoning. He said, my testimony is supported by my Father who tells me what to say. I only say what I hear him saying. I don't even judge by my own human reasoning. Even Jesus didn't. He could have. But he relied on that intimate communication at every moment, right? So you with me on that? So you understand the difference between the tree of intimacy with God and the tree of the human, separate, independent, discerning knowledge of good and evil. Do you understand that concept? Okay. This is what I think he wants me to go over today. It's a big, big topic, but I compress it. I want to explain Greek thought and how the Greek Empire paved the way for Christianity. I want to explain how Greek thought paved the way for humanism and the Olympics and the Septuagint and the translation of all the scriptures into Greek. I want to show you the good and evil that came out of the Greek Empire, because the same thing will happen in the days that we're living in. The technology and the knowledge and the language and the unification of a culture can be used for good or evil. And in the first century, it was used for both good and evil. And I want you to understand that. And I think the Greek conquest of the Middle East is the best way to show the Antichrist spirit in the last days and how knowledge will be used for both good and evil. Okay? I want to try to explain that as carefully and smoothly as I can. How many, you know what the Septuagint is? Okay, this is important. Alexander the Great conquered. Remember how there were beasts on Daniel's statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw? There were four parts of the statue, and there were beasts also. And they represent the same thing, which was the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. I'm pointing downward as the statue moved down, if you've read Daniel. So the head of gold was Babylon. The chest of silver was the one that came after Babylon that conquered them. That was the Medo-Persians. The one that came next was the belly of bronze, and that was the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great. And then the legs of iron were the Roman Empire that conquered Greece in 63 BC. And that was the beast empire into which Jesus chose to be born. Okay, the Roman Empire. And then remember, there were feet of iron mixed with clay, which was an end-time resurrected version of the Roman Empire with 10 toes or 10 10 political structures that would lead it. And we're not doing a teaching on that final end time beast empire at this moment, but it'll come into play a little bit. But we're going to focus on the belly of bronze, which was the Greek Empire. Okay, are you somewhat familiar with the passage? If not, I don't have time to explain it right now, but read Daniel 2, I think has the statue in it. I think Daniel 2. And I'll find that for you. But anyway, here's the thing. When Alexander the Great conquered Israel, it was 332 BC. He took over from the Medo-Persians. He was a military commander. 9 years after he took over Israel, he was dead at a very, very early age in his 30s. No one knows if he was poisoned or how he died. But his empire was divided into four parts, the Greek Empire. And two of those parts became great dynasties. They became empires unto themselves. The two dynasties that Alexander the Great's Greek Empire were divided into were Egypt and Syria. The dynasty of Egyptian kings was called the Ptolemies, but there's a P in front of the T, but you don't pronounce the P, so it's the Ptolemy dynasty. And the Syrian dynasty is called the Seleucid dynasty, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D. Ptolemy is P-T-O-L-O-M-Y. Spelling bee over? Okay. So anyway, Alexander's empire was divided into four parts, but we're focusing on the two called the Egyptians and the Syrians. Now, the Ptolemies treated the Jews really well. When the Egyptian rulers were in charge of Israel from about 320 BC till about 195 BC, the Egyptian rulers treated Israel well. What do I mean by that? They allowed them to have their temple sacrifice and their worship. They allowed them to be Jews. They left them alone. In fact, they respected the Jews so much that Ptolemy Philadelphus, one of the pharaohs, or I forget if he called himself a pharaoh at that point, but he was a king. In 250 BC, Ptolemy Philadelphus asked for 72 of the best rabbis in Jerusalem to be shipped over to an island off of Alexandria, Egypt, to translate the entire Old Testament into Greek. Okay? That's how we got the Septuagint that became the Bible of all the early Christians that wrote the New Testament, the early Jewish Christians. Greek became the language of the Jewish marketplace as the Jews were scattered into Greek-speaking cultures. So Ptolemy Philadelphus was, I think he was a God-fearing Gentile from reading Josephus's history of this. So they shipped 72 of the smartest rabbis in 250 BC, and they spent 72 days on an island off of Alexandria, Egypt. And they translated the whole Hebrew scriptures into Greek. Now, Greek scholars say it's not the best Greek in the world because they were taking Hebrew thoughts and trying to put it into the Greek language. And that's an awkward transition. However, it became wildly popular among the Gentiles to read the Torah in Greek. And so it brought about a revival among the Gentiles before Messiah was born, a couple hundred years before Messiah was born. So we call that the Septuagint because Septuagint means 70, based on the 70 elders that wrote it. As you know, Paul and the writer of Hebrews, who was probably Barnabas, a Sadducean priest who became a believer, they used the Septuagint in all their quotes of the Old Testament that you see in the New Testament. They all quoted from the Septuagint. And when Paul went and preached to the Gentiles, he always preached in Greek using his Septuagint translation. So can you see how the Egyptian branch of the Greek Empire was used for good? The technology was used for good. The translation where Greek became the unified language of the known civilized world, God used that for good. He created a Bible that everyone could understand. And most of the Jews who had been scattered didn't even speak Hebrew anymore. So they needed a Greek translation just as much as the Gentiles did. Because I would not be able to understand my own scriptures in Hebrew. I could read a little bit of it, but I could never, ever get out of it what I do in my mother tongue because I'm scattered to the English-speaking world, and that's comfortable for me. So it was really the same back then, okay? And so for a while, the Ptolemies were good to the Jews, and we got this wonderful Greek Bible out of the deal. But there arose, remember I said the other division was the Syrians? Well, the Syrians and the Egyptians were always fighting, having wars over who would control